This is CliffCentral.com.
Worksman's Attorneys is a proudly South African corporate and commercial law firm with over 100 years of experience. With over 200 lawyers practicing in over 22 diverse areas of law, they're able to contend with current, topical matters and use their expertise to your advantage. In this series of podcasts, we will explore how the law affects you. Welcome to another episode in a series on some of the things that worksmen's in particular are involved in with regard to the law and the application of that law and how it affects you. And I think we've covered a number of interesting subjects so far. One of the subjects which always comes up in South Africa, and it seems to be something which is inherently South African, no matter how far you go back into our history, labor law is something that pops its head up and either creates huge controversy or at very least a lot of conversation, and sometimes quite active and quite passionate conversation. And certainly there is no dearth of that kind of content with respect to the stuff that we're interested in talking to Jacques van Wyk about today. He is a director in labor and unemployment from the Cape Town office of Worksmen's. Jacques, it's a pleasure to meet you and it's a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Thanks for coming to spend some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, labor law is really a labor of love for you in some ways, isn't it?
It is.
Something you've been involved in.
I've practiced this area of law since completing my articles.
Yeah.
So that's about 20 odd years that I've been doing this. So I've seen the evolution of employment law from our former employment law under the 1956 Act to the introduction of our revolutionary new Labor Relations Act in 1996.
What is the regulatory framework in South Africa and how complicated is it? I often hear people talking about, oh, we're the most regulated labor law environment in the world. Is that an exaggeration, is an overstatement of the reality, or has that got some space that is occupied by the truth in statements like that?
I think you can't ignore our history when you consider where the Labor Relations Act should be positioned in South Africa. It was one of the first pieces of legislation to be introduced under the new regime. It flows directly from the Constitution. So unlike many other countries, the right to fair labor practices is enshrined in the Bill of Rights. So it's quite unusual. Mm-hmm. The Labor Relations Act is subject only to the Constitution. It trumps all other acts except the Constitution. So it's extremely powerful. It was a codification of a lot of decisions by our old industrial court, which operated under the 1956 Act. It legalized, in a sense, strike action, which was always a contentious issue. Mm-hmm. Made it simpler for people to exercise their right to strike. It borrows from some of the First World jurisdictions. It borrows from the Industrial Labor Organization, the ILO. It creates fairly complex dispute resolution processes. So in all respects, a First World but complex system that has been introduced.
And the context of all of this is that for a very long time in our history, there weren't any labor relations. People who worked for a certain amount of money would do whatever they were told. There wasn't a lot of protection. Strikes had very much a political character as much as they did a social or economic character. And so for us, it isn't just labor relations. There's also a lot of emotive stuff that comes into these discussions, right?
Absolutely. To elevate the right to strike to a Bill of Rights constitutional right gives you some indication of the political sensitivity around this. We went from a situation where workers were exploited, where they didn't have the right to strike, where they were subject to incarceration for striking in the early days, to a system which rectified that. So it's a swinging of the pendulum, in a sense, from very little protection to significant protection.
We're in a time now where perhaps that pendulum that you've mentioned to me before is swinging again. We look at labor strikes, and at the moment there is this Eskom situation, which is very much on people's minds. Mm. But it could be any week in South Africa that there's a strike in some sector. Mm. It's mining, it's metal workers, it's people in manufacturing, it's teachers. It seems to me that we almost have an unhealthy relationship with the need to strike, or with that as the only possible way to resolve a situation, when for many people it should be the last tool in the shed when you've run out of other tools. I mean, how do you feel about that? Have we got an oversupply of strikes?
We have significant numbers of strikes. Annually, we have what we refer to colloquially as strike season, which indicates to you what's become the norm. So at a certain point every year, we all anticipate that strikes will start happening. Strikes also typically in South Africa have a violent element to it, something which is very concerning. It concerns the public, it concerns employers, and I'm sure many, many employees. So unlike Europe, where you have centralized bargaining and everybody sits down very courteously and civilly around the table and they negotiate and they have an agreement that applies to all, we haven't reached that point yet. We still are very enterprise-based in regard to wage issues and so on. So one business will fight an issue or maybe a sector. But the level of centralized bargaining that you need to avoid strikes just hasn't evolved yet in South Africa.
And you mentioned the violent element to this. So there are also the threats and intimidation that occur for people who aren't even necessarily involved with the union, which also seems to happen more often than not.
Yes, it does. We have a very high incidence of violent strikes. Yeah. Violent in the sense of harm to people who may not be willing to strike, who want to work, to the public who want to contract or transact with the employer that's being the victim or the subject matter of that strike action. The strikes often boil over into the public domain. So even though you and I have nothing to do with the strike, we may find litter on the streets or we may find roads blocked. So that is unfortunately...
Property damage.
Property damage, vehicle damage and so on. So strikes tend to end up at that point. And what I've seen in my experience is that it's often a very small group of strikers. So I'm not suggesting that all workers in this country are ready to resort to violence. That's not the case. It's typically a small group.
And sometimes there are even agitators who might, according to the unions anyway, a lot of the time, might not even have anything to do with the strike, who are troublemakers, who come in and make them look bad. Sometimes that's also a convenient excuse, but
yes,
it does happen.
Hard to determine whether it's true, but yeah, in some cases, yes, that does happen. There are opportunistic people who join a strike and see an opportunity. You know, when shop windows are broken, yeah, and looting takes place, then typically the unions will not take responsibility for that, and certainly neither will their members. So it's very hard, though, to determine in the heat of the moment who's responsible for what. Our courts have, however, increasingly said that they will be holding unions liable for the conduct of their employees and their members during these strikes. So that has, in a sense, put them on terms to say you need to ensure that strikes are as they were intended to be. They are intended to be peaceful.
Tamed to a degree.
Yeah.
What is the new labor relations, what are the new amendments to the Labor Relations Act mean for strikes?
Well, there are a raft of changes that have been proposed. One of them is to the Labor Relations Act, and it has been heavily criticized by trade unions because they see it as an attempt to curtail the right to strike. So the right to strike is a right which is protected vigorously by trade unions. It's something that they fought for a long time. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, employers are saying, we can't afford to lose property, vehicles. We can't afford to be the victims of violent strikes. You're entitled to your strike. Follow the procedure. It's very easy to end up with a protected strike, it's called. Don't resort to wildcat strikes or to unlawful conduct during a protected strike. So the amendments are looking at when does a strike, is it no longer functional, is the word that's used, no longer functional for collective bargaining. And when that happens, there's a indication that a commission may very well determine that strike is no longer functional, and that may actually change what was previously a lawful strike to an unlawful strike?
Well, I would imagine that it would be in the interests of someone who thought that a strike may do them some harm, whether it's financially or otherwise, to engage with a lawyer such as yourself to determine whether or not a strike is still functional and thereby have it declared illegal and put an end to it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that it to some extent, the concerns raised by trade unions are valid, that this process may very well then be abused to neuter them, to hobble them in their attempt to exercise their collective power. At the end of the day, when it comes to wages, that's the only real way that a collective can bring pressure to bear on capital to increase wages.
I just want to get hold of the context of South Africa's current labor market and what's actually going on. Do we have any idea of how many people in South Africa, by percentage anyway, are employed, and then how many of those employed people are unionized? Even if it's a ballpark figure, I'm trying to sort of draw the picture, because I know that we've got a much bigger unemployment problem than we do a labor relations problem.
I can express a view on the trend. So the trend of unemployment, especially amongst the youth, is on the rise, which is alarming. So there's a generation of first-time employees who aren't finding employment.
Are they not finding employment because there just isn't employment? Or are they not... Are we not, as a country, able to find enough candidates for the jobs that we need?
I think it's probably both. I think there's a mixture of both.
That's very worrying.
Yeah. The when you leave school and you are unable to find the education at school or at a tertiary level, that's the first problem. The second problem is, to the extent that business is not able to absorb these increased number of employees that are entering, or potential employees that are entering the labor market, that then creates a problem. You have a generation of people who are unable to find employment. That is a problem.
And then unionization?
Well, trade unionization, it has been reported, is on the decline. There are a number of unions that are in trouble, that are in financial difficulty.
We know that they sort of turn on each other occasionally, as we've seen in mining anyway.
We've seen a split in Casato with a breakaway with Mr. Varvey and so on. So, yes, there is that's happening as well. So there's a concern that the trade union movement in South Africa is losing steam, which is a problem, because employees and a functioning trade union organization is important for any economy.
And they've spent years building relationships.
Correct, absolutely. So there's no doubt that there are a number of employees in our country who are still not being treated fairly. And trade unions play a very important role in servicing those needs.
Can we move on to retrenchments for a minute? Because this is an area where I think people often engage with the law, and where they need to know the law. And because our labor relations legislation is a lot more complex than in most countries, I mean, you were telling me a story about how in America you can only take so many personal possessions to work that you could fit them in a box, because you could be retrenched and told on that day, and you'll have to vacate your desk and you'll be given a box, and whatever doesn't fit in the box is your problem.
So that's correct.
And they can literally retrench you in that kind of space.
There are jurisdictions, we call jurisdictions or countries, where the employer's ability to respond to economic challenges is paramount.
In other words, they don't even have to explain to you why they're firing you. They just say you're out, like Donald Trump did on The Apprentice. Just say you're fired, yes. And then they're out.
Yes, you could. Absolutely. Wow.
And in this country, that's not possible at all.
No. Now, here, in fact, a dismissal for what we call operational requirements, otherwise known as retrenchment, is probably one of the most complex forms of dismissal that you can have. In fact, the Labor Relations Act has sections dedicated to this type of dismissal, whereas it doesn't have in regard to other forms of dismissal. So we have typically...
Do you know why that is?
Well, because of the fact that it is so, it's a no-fault dismissal. So the employee's done nothing wrong. Employee's come to work on time, has done his or her job, and for reasons completely beyond their control, they face the loss of employment. So in order to require employers to go the extra mile before doing that. That should be your last resort.
Right.
And there are sections in the Labor Relations Act which set out a process that must be followed for small or large-scale retrenchments, things that the employer has to do before ending up at that point, an obligation to consult with trade unions who represent affected employees or with employees themselves, time periods that must be complied with. There's provision that the CCMA can get involved to facilitate large-scale retrenchments. So it's a highly regulated area in our law.
But surely if a business can't carry on employing 10 people and they need to cut it down to 5, otherwise they're going to go out of business, it's in the interest not only of the 5 who will remain, but of everybody that the business remain in operation, that there's almost an implicit understanding from a maths and, yes, and ledger point of view,
yes,
that this is what has to happen.
The question though about that formula is the answer to the financial challenge getting rid of people? Maybe the answer is to reduce remuneration for a period of time.
Or hours.
Maybe reduce hours. Mm. Maybe explore other cost-cutting exercises. So the law is aimed at saying, please consider all of those
before
you fire a human being and leave them without employment, where they've done nothing wrong.
Yeah,
so that's the issue.
But do we have a problem understanding why employment takes place? I mean, at a political level now, and this is philosophy. I want to get back to the law in a second.
Yes.
But I need to pick your brain while I have your fine brain here, because you've thought about these things a lot more than I ever will. Mm. So do we have a problem understanding why employment exists? Do we imagine in South Africa broadly,
yes,
and particularly in our political elites, that employment is some kind of a right, that it's something that people... It keeps them busy and they earn a salary.
Mm.
Not that it is to be engaged in production in some way, in adding value to society in some way, and being rewarded for that with money.
So I'll be very careful in my response, because I'm now speaking for every single employee in the country. I do think that the cold, hard approach to 1 + 1 = 2 from an employment law point of view, which may apply in America, for instance,
does not apply.
Not necessarily apply in South Africa. There's a recognition that employment of one person enriches a range of other people around them,
mm-hmm,
not just them. That it affects communities. That it affects a sense of worth, and so on. That it is not a right, but certainly it's something that must be looked after.
Okay.
But not,
it's a priority.
Not just by the employee. The employee has an obligation to look after their employment too. But employers are asked to think about terminating employment as a last resort when they're in financial difficulties or before considering economic, technological changes and so on.
Well, that brings into the discussion the idea of mechanization, the idea of robots, the idea of machines eventually taking people's jobs. A lot of people are very nervous about this.
Yes.
Particularly in a world where technology is advancing so fast that we're able to replace human labor in some cases, sometimes human skills, and sometimes even human thinking in certain ways, and sometimes better by the machines than us.
Mm.
This makes people nervous because they imagine that they won't be useful in a future economy. Has that come into the application of and the promulgation of law in South African labor?
It absolutely has. We just spoke about retrenchments. One of the reasons the law recognizes a retrenchment can happen is for technological reasons. So an employer who wants to introduce technology that's going to cause the redundancy of posts has to follow the same procedure that he would have or she would have to follow if needing to retrench people for financial reasons.
Hmm.
So operational requirements, that term in the law, is defined as including technological issues. So if you're going to introduce a machine that effectively makes 20 people redundant, before you do so, you have to start consulting with those 20 people. Say, look, I'm contemplating doing this. Is there some other way I can achieve my operational goal without the loss of 20 people? Now, that doesn't mean necessarily not introducing the technology. It may mean training people to operate the technology, and instead of just throwing away 20 people, maybe limiting that loss to 15 people or 10 people and upskilling other people to operate their technology.
While those may be admirable in respect of keeping people employed, those things can sometimes make it very hard to run a business. And they are sometimes even obfuscatory in their nature. Now, I'm not coming at this as a hard capitalist. In fact, I don't want us to get too much into the philosophy of this. But is it a complex process to go through? If I found a machine that was able to do what five employees here do, it's almost my duty as a responsible business owner to put that technology to action as quickly as possible. If I came to you and said, I'm going to do this, how can I make this as painless as possible for the business and for the people who I'm going to have to retrench? Where do you even begin?
You would have to begin where you begin with any retrenchment process. You'd have to begin with a consultation exercise. You'd have to, before you made the decision to do anything that causes the loss of employment, the loss of job security, or fundamental change to terms and conditions of employment, you'd have to engage with those people who you potentially will have to fire because of this introduction of this technology. It doesn't mean you can't do it.
Sure.
So the law doesn't require that you have to reach consensus or agreement with them. You don't have to have an agreement. It's not a negotiation. It's a consultation.
This is a difficult place to legislate, and it's a difficult place for us to find out, and there must be a lot of case law that has helped to make this instructive for people who wouldn't have the faintest idea. But you can't, you can say someone must engage with a member of staff, they must consult with a member of staff, but you can't really prescribe the nature of that consultation. A nice, friendly boss who really cares will always do a better job of that than someone who is a mercenary who's only interested in the bottom line and who doesn't give a damn about how many hungry mouths are at home.
So the law requires that you do it in good faith, that you engage in what's called joint consensus seeking consultation, and that you not pay lip service to the law. To the extent that that can be proven at a later stage, so if you're a nasty employer and you say, I'm just going to tick the boxes, you will come up short at the end of the day.
That's interesting, because that's almost the law trying to regulate the kind of communication that humans must have with each other.
Yes.
Which is interesting, because it can get quite grey, right?
Yes.
It's not black and white.
Correct. There's no clear definition on what consultation means. It's simply our courts have grappled with this idea and have said you must approach it with an open mind and have looked at, well, there was this proposal on the table. Why didn't you give it serious consideration? But even the courts are reluctant to go so far as to say to an employer, well, that wasn't a good business decision, or it was a bad decision. The court will say, as long as the business decision was bona fide in the circumstances, after you'd consulted with an open mind, with the trade union or the employees, then the prerogative still lies with the employer at the end of the day. But it is a complex area. And
I think it's fascinating because what you're really doing is you're also trying to figure out what someone else is thinking.
Yes.
A lot of the time.
Yes.
Did they have malice aforethought? Did they intend to employ this person with the ultimate goal of getting rid of them once they had served a certain very short purpose?
So the easy example is where a viable proposal is put on the table and just ignored out of hand.
Okay.
That would be an easy example. But you're right. When you get closer to the center where, well, was it a good proposal? Should we have considered that? Would it have worked? Then the judge's position gets a bit more difficult because
yours in trying to prove anything.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is the trick.
I mean, you could say, well, we have a recording of a telephone call in which you can hear the tone is, you know, not particularly conciliatory.
Yes.
But that's an interpretive thing, and it gets very messy.
Absolutely. I
suppose experience here is the best ally you could have.
Correct. I mean, the successful challenge to that, where you're acting for an employee, is to say, well, there was clearly a viable alternative, and if you had selected this alternative, you would have saved five instead of not saving the five. And for that reason, the dismissal was unfair, and they should never have been dismissed in the first place.
How busy is the CCMA in South Africa?
It's extremely busy. I read recently it's the busiest dispute resolution forum in the world. At the moment.
So, in the world. What are most of the disputes about?
Mostly the disputes are about unfair dismissals for misconduct. So that's your dismissal for theft or late coming or assault, that type of dismissal. So it's not the retrenchment.
That's not great.
Yeah. No, it's not.
What does that tell us about our labor force?
Well, it
I don't mean to be controversial or glib about this, but if that many people are appearing, that it's keeping the CCMA that busy.
It doesn't mean they're all guilty, though.
No,
I think
sure,
we must accept that a lot of them are reinstated.
Absolutely.
What it does mean is that
there's a very big gap in trust between employer and employee if this is happening.
It means that a lot of people, unfortunately, are dismissed for not conducting themselves in the proper way. Now, the figure about how many are reinstated retrospectively or reinstated is not available. But the point is that that is the most common form of dismissal. It may be that employers see that as the easiest way of dismissing employees. You see, that's the other side. So that's a statistic we must be careful of, I think.
Let's just talk quickly about minimum wage, because that's something which comes up often in South Africa. And I don't know if I even have a position on this. I'm not well informed enough. And perhaps you can help me in order to reach a point where I'm ready to say this is my opinion on it. Maybe many of us feel this way. It's become a bit of a political football as well.
Yes.
What's your take on the current status of the minimum wage discussion, of where you think it might go, and what would be optimal in your opinion based on your experience? This is only your I'm asking particularly here for your opinion on this. And then how we could better run discussions like this where we've fallen perhaps short of the best expectation here.
Yeah. The national minimum wage will be enacted. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
It's at the national, the NCOP. Mm-hmm. So it's gone through the House, the Assembly. There are regulations that have been issued. They are up for discussion and public comment. So it will happen. Mm-hmm. The question I think that everyone has is, what will the employer's response be to this? The regulations make provision for an exemption process where you can apply for an exemption. And I've had a number of queries already on what process must be followed. It's going to be quite a streamlined online process. It's quite forward-thinking, and it's technologically advanced.
That's good.
Yeah, it's going to be online. It will be limited for 12 months, so your exemption is not forever. It's for 12 months. You have to submit a whole range of things, and you need the input from organized labor, which is good. So how employers will respond, we'll have to see. But you can look at other examples in the farming sector. When a minimum wage was introduced in the farming sector, it did lead, unfortunately, to retrenchments, because there are going to be employers who won't be able to afford that wage. At the same time, we have a wage which is pitifully low.
Yeah, it's what, how much?
20 rand an hour.
Yeah, 20 rand an hour.
It's very, very low. I mean, the net result of that sort of increase is people who will still be earning, most people would say, below the poverty line. Mm. So it's not, it points to a bigger problem, I think. And that is that there are low wages, there are many unskilled workers in this country who are struggling to survive, and that this is aimed at assisting them, I guess, and stimulating the economy.
Social media.
Yes.
I assume, I was talking to your colleague Bernard Hotz about how he has been assisted by social media in many ways, because it's a source of tremendous evidence.
Absolutely.
And I can imagine that even in labor, this is sometimes a very helpful thing to resort to when you have two sides of a story and you're not sure which one is true.
Yes.
And perhaps there's a third version which is the most accurate, and that's usually the technology, because why would it lie?
Yes.
I'm interested, though, in, before we get into that, because that might come into how you would take on a case and what your line of reasoning might be and how you would go about trying to get your client's best version of events. But first of all, employees and the difference that social media and that the internet has made for an employee applying for a job, keeping a job, staying within the rules during the time that they're there in terms of social media and everything else. I've heard lots of stories about people who are very draconian about what they allow and don't allow on social media in terms of their employees. I've heard about employees who insist on their freedom of expression and often get it. Do you think we're making some headway here? It's a very new area of law.
It's extremely new, and the way it's developing is very interesting. So in our country and with our history and our background, there are certain things that one would expect everyone knew they should never do. Yet you find employees making racist statements on social media platforms. Aside from the fact that it's abhorrent and shouldn't be permitted, the fact that they make those statements and then identified as being associated with or connected to an employer will almost always, I would think, in a right-thinking employer's mind, lead to a question as to whether I should still employ this person.
And there would be dismissal. Absolutely. On the grounds of reputational damage,
correct.
Brand damage.
So correct, absolutely. I mean,
threat to the business.
Well, an employer must decide whether they're going to tolerate an employee who makes a racist statement
surely
on a social platform.
Surely not.
And I cannot imagine.
I don't know that there's one company
correct.
In South Africa that would stand up for
I cannot
that.
Imagine. Correct. I can't imagine that there'll be anyone who will tolerate that.
Yeah.
So it's a new area. Employees sometimes regard it as a private space.
Mm-hmm.
It's time that employees learn that because you are publishing and broadcasting, in a sense, to a wider media, you must be very careful what you say, because it will come back and hurt you if you say something which is unlawful, patently unlawful,
mm-hmm.
And you cause reputational harm to your employer. So it is just clearly the same as standing on a soapbox in front of your employer's premises and making statements which bring them into disrepute. That maybe that's the test you should adopt before pressing send.
Yeah. So, would you say this to your boss's
face? If my
face?
Employer read this now, what would they do?
Tell me, when it comes to applying for jobs, which are scarce, we've talked about unemployment already. Not enough, I should guess, but we've discussed it at very least. When you're applying for a job, employers now look at your social media, they look at your history online. It's the best background information check that
yes.
you ever have.
Well,
and you're volunteering this information.
Absolutely. So we live in an age where we unfortunately have CV fraud, something that employers are increasingly concerned about. There's also concern about the veracity of certificates and degrees and so on. So employers, sophisticated employers, typically do background checks. Because of the publicity that that would be attracted to them employing the wrong person, or if there's a statement made in the past on the internet that might bring them to dispute, they do look at these sort of things. And it's very easy to Google someone. And so, yes, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. You would want to see whether this person has done something or stands for something or is associated with someone or something that would cause harm to your business.
Is it difficult to employ people in South Africa, and is it difficult to dismiss people in South Africa?
I don't think it's difficult to employ people in South Africa. We have a large number of people who are looking for employment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a general statement. If from a skilled point of view, there might be greater difficulty there. And that just may be because we aren't producing enough skilled or semi-skilled people in this country, and certainly not in the right areas. Once employed, yes, we are a regulated society. We and our employment community is very regulated. But there are fairly straightforward rules that apply when it comes to dismissing someone. If someone has committed an offence which is serious enough, and you follow the tenets of the law and the code of good practice, then it shouldn't pose any difficulty.
As a lawyer, do you find that there are constant updates to this law which you have to keep yourself abreast of? And does your team, in particular, the individuals who are dealing with ongoing labor law
yes.
cases, do they have to constantly be learning about the new amendments to bills, new case law? Obviously, this is true for all law,
yes.
but in labor law, do you think that it's particularly important? It is a very liquid part of
it's,
our,
it's
of our
a
law,
fascinating
right?
area of law.
Yeah.
We have new law being made not only at Parliament but also by our judges and the Constitutional Court. Because of the nature of employment law and because it often ends up involving a constitutional issue, we have this magnificent court with these very, very skilled and intellectual and, in my view, brilliant judges mm-hmm. issuing judgments from the Constitutional Court that we constantly have to keep up with. There's case law on temporary employment services. You know, we know them as labor brokers.
Yes.
We're waiting for a very important judgment from the Constitutional Court. They heard it on the 22nd of February. It's going to have a significant impact on that sector, which is very important. So it's every day something new happens.
Why is it so hard for government to get rid of people who they've decided to get rid of? We hear about, you know, acting CEOs and acting commissioners and acting CFOs and people who are in positions and they're on suspension for years at a time. Mm. Is that just an inability to make decisions? Is it that the law needs some kind of amendment or alteration? Or is there a much deeper problem?
So what's happening in government is I can't say. But what I can say is the following, is that if you suspect someone has committed an offence and you put them on precautionary suspension, it should not be for years. You should know at the time of suspension more or less what your concerns are. You should investigate them expeditiously and you should convene an inquiry. Have the inquiry and make a finding.
Is that what happens in the private sector?
That's what happens in the private sector. And that's what the law contemplates.
The law should be the same for both.
The law is the same for both. That's what's contemplated. Okay. It's not a process that should be stuck for years. It makes no sense. You either have a case or you don't. If you don't, unsuspend the employee, bring them back, let them carry on with their job. If you have a basis for dismissing them, proceed with your inquiry, present your evidence and so on. So it may be that there's a resource issue. It may be there's a problem gathering evidence. There may be that there's an issue about a will to do something about it. It may just not be convenient to do something about it.
And I suppose we could speculate about
that for
a long time. Yeah. You must have dealt with some really big cases. I mean, there must be some enormous quantum involved in some of these. Mm-hmm. Does that affect your excitement around it? It may not affect the quality of work you'd think would be consistent. But if you know you're doing some enormous case for an individual or a company, and there's a lot of money at stake, does that somehow make it much more of a motivational environment and the particulars of that case a lot more interesting?
Well, it may be more interesting, but from an application point of view, my personal philosophy is whether it's a pro bono matter, mm-hmm, for an employee who can't afford a lawyer. So we do that work. We have a pro bono office at the Labour Court where we take on work for indigent persons. We apply the same level of vigour, same level of intellect, same concern and care to resolving their matter as we would for any multinational. I would hope every attorney applies that professional conduct and ethic to their work. So it's whether there's a greater pressure on you when you're dealing with a 165 million rand claim or versus a 100,000 rand claim, well, I mean, there may be. But from a point of view of applying your skill, you should apply the same level of care and skill to every matter that comes across your desk. That's my duty.
Well, I suppose we could also argue that if you do those pro bono matters, the way it could change people's lives might even be more significant.
Correct.
Than any amount of money to a
Correct.
Rich person.
It's all relative. It's all relative.
It really must be fascinating to be involved in this stuff every day because you get to look at the underbelly of South Africa's economy. Mm. You get to see the people who are being employed, the people who are employing those people, what makes the wheels turn. It must give you tremendous insight into whether or not the economy is in a healthy state or not.
Mm. Well, it does. I mean, we deal with a range of matters. It'll be large-scale retrenchments, which is an indicator of where we are. On the up, we deal with recruitment. So when it's good, we help employers with incentive plans and recruitment. When it's bad, unfortunately, we help them restructure their businesses to survive. So we see all aspects, the both sides of the cycle, if you will. We also obviously deal with people who have been unfairly dismissed in atrocious circumstances, who were removed because, for instance, they blew the whistle on some sort of crime. And so that's particularly satisfying to help someone in those circumstances where they were doing the right thing and they were dismissed for that reason. Or people who were victimized because of their gender or because a woman chose to be pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Those sort of matters are very important to prosecute. Very important.
I would imagine also that you get to see some unscrupulous activity.
Mm.
And that must be quite enlightening too, because the human nature, you think you know something about the way people behave. And I think sometimes people do take advantage of relationships, whether it's from an employer or an employee's point of view.
Yes.
Well, and sometimes in partnerships, and sometimes in the structure of businesses.
So we certainly do act for people who have been unfairly treated, and one it boggles the mind to think that an employee would ever contemplate getting away with that type of behavior. My clients typically, I'm happy to say, I've not been asked to defend matters which are of that. Maybe they just don't come to me because they know who I am. But the point is that we strive to give advice to a client which is, these are your rights, these are your obligations, and we would suggest that you follow those routes. When it comes to employees who have been unfairly dismissed, we obviously take those employers who aren't our clients to task.
Right.
Mm.
How do you think when you look at it, and perhaps this is a figurative thing, when you look at the relations between labor and employers, do you think in South Africa we've done much to improve the balance, to make it a little more equal? Or do you think it's tipped in one direction?
There's so many facets to the employment community or landscape in South Africa. So it depends where you look. If you're looking in sort of the financial sector or the very sophisticated sector where you have highly skilled or semi-skilled employees, then you'll find that the bargaining level is far more equal.
Mm.
But then you look in sectors where there's high level of manual labor, for instance, or labor intensive.
So we're talking farms or factories?
Farms, factories, those sort of areas. You do find that there is not an unfairness, but certainly the power vests with the employer. Mm. There's a huge amount of power still there. And so, yes, I would think in those circumstances, not necessarily fair to say that the bargaining power of the partners in that relationship are on an equal level.
Sounds like great work. It sounds like the kind of information that will certainly benefit me. People who are either looking for a job, people who found a job, and people who want to leave a job. So there's ticking all those boxes. Thank you very much, Jacques, for your time. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Jacques van Wyk is a director in labor and employment at Worksmans in Cape Town. It's the most interesting stuff. Labor law is how we all earn our keep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Worksmans Attorneys is a proudly South African corporate and commercial law firm with over 100 years of experience. With over 200 lawyers practicing in over 22 diverse areas of law, they're able to contend with current, topical matters and use their expertise to your advantage. In this series of podcasts, we will explore how the law affects you.
This is CliffCentral.com.